Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Plato and Socrates, you know, if somebody was a disbeliever, they would say that obviously Muhammad and the family of Muhammad and even certain narrations in Christianity and Judaism has stolen from and plagiarized from these individuals that they have now thrown out, or the majority of the Islamic scholars and Christian and Jewish scholars have thrown out of the fold of prophethood.
I mean, I have no words to describe it. Like, it's actually giving me goosebumps because I just can't believe that that something like this has been preserved throughout history, and we find that it exactly parallels what Imam Ahmad al-Hassan and you have taught us.
And I think that this also serves as proof for who can be the successor of Plato and Socrates, except for a man who believes in and teaches and propagates the ideas that were preserved by Socrates and Plato.
Yeah, absolutely.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad al-Imma wal-Mahdiyina wa sallam taslima. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my dear companion Tiffany.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear father.
How are you?
I'm good, alhamdulillah. How are you?
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me here.
God bless you. Thank you for enduring all these hours and all these months and years with me.
It's my great honor. Like, there's nowhere in the world I would rather be than sitting right here with you. It is such a huge honor, and I really appreciate it.
God bless you. Today I wanted to talk with you about something which I was pondering over and I thought was quite interesting. It was that narration, actually, that we discussed recently in one of the episodes of the Hall of Mysteries. It was a narration from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, in which one of the imams was basically speaking to one of his companions and saying, he was responding to a question that the companion had posed, and he was saying basically that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had sent all of these great miracles with Moses alayhi salam. These miracles were basically like magic, because the people at his time were obsessed with magic, and that is what was basically said, or that is what was being practiced or heavily available in the region at that time. People were obsessed with magic. That was almost like the language that they spoke, and therefore when God wanted to speak to them, you know, and to establish the proof upon them, he used that which they were obsessed with, or the language which they spoke, as a proof against them, right? Yes. And so he sent forward Moses with magic, the likes that they were unable to explain and the likes which they were unable to produce. Hence, Moses has this big confrontation with the magicians, and he does the exact same thing which they do. They throw down their staffs and it becomes serpents. And that's a great wonder for everybody that's there. But Moses does the exact same thing, except that his staff turns into a serpent, which is much greater and larger, and it swallows all of the rest of the serpents. And in one particular tradition, it was so big that it almost swallowed Pharaoh himself, as a demonstration of great power and authority in front of everybody. And so they do something which is this feat, which is unexplainable. And people call it magic, and Moses does the exact same thing. And they were also doing other types of magic. And in some traditions or narrations, it basically states that almost all of the miracles that Moses brought forward during his time, these were mimicking, or they were copies of greater copies or greater manifestations of the same types of acts that the magicians at the time were producing. And then the narration goes on to basically state that, and Jesus, when he went to his people, he went to his people with medicine, medicine the likes that they did not have, because that is what was important. And that's what people were obsessed with at that time, was with medicine and finding cures for the different ailments and diseases that the people suffered from. And then therefore he went forward and he was curing people, and he was like a doctor for the people, and he was bringing forth, cures to diseases and ailments that nobody had the ability to cure. He would be able to cure them. And so God used medicine as a proof against the people that were speaking the language of medicine at that time. And then the narration basically states that, and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he came with eloquence and poetry. And that is because that it was the language of the time. The people were poets, so the people were competing in poetry, that's what was the big thing at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in that region. And so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brought forward Muhammad reciting the Quran in such eloquence and in a poetic form, the likes that nobody was able to produce the same effect of. And so it was like a miracle, the establishment of the language of the people of the time against the people of the time, that became, a proof, and it was a miracle, so to speak, right? Because it was like, it's not that the Quran is not poetry. The Quran is poetry. It's not that what Jesus was doing was not medicine. It was medicine. It's not that what Moses was doing was not magic. It was magic. But also at the same time, the magic and the medicine and the poetry were all miraculous, because nobody was able to produce the likes thereof.
That's a very interesting pattern.
Yeah. The end of the hadith ends with the imam basically stating that, and for the people of this day and age, it's intelligence, right? And I thought that was interesting, because here we have in the narration four different languages, or four different things, four different areas that were used as proofs against the people of their time. And I thought, we have 124,000 prophets and messengers that were sent. And nowhere in the narration does it state that, the medicine miracle was the same for all of the successors of Jesus, or that the poetry was the same for all of the successors of Muhammad. It's actually saying something opposite to that, because here we have one of the imams saying that, the proof for the people of his time is intelligence, not poetry, right? Not eloquence. So it's like different.
Yeah.
And I thought, how many other forms out there are there, that, or areas of expertise or areas of interest of human culture and thought and science did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala use as a proof against the people of their time? That's what I've been contemplating over.
That's a very interesting question. And it does stand to reason that there would be more, right? If that's the way that God operates, and that's the way that he communicates with people, and he proves himself through his messengers, like using the language that is like spoken and known to the people at the time, that there would be more of these languages that God would have used in the past.
Yeah. And you know what I came to think about? My memory went back to when I was a young child, and I was being homeschooled. And I was in this homeschooling system. And I was probably somewhere in like third grade or something of the sort. And we had this course that we had to do. One of the classes that I had to take was a class of mythology.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And I came to think about mythology. And I came to think about Aristotle.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. a brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Plato and Socrates and Plato. And I came to think about many other famous philosophers during that time period that not only were they considered prophets and messengers in the narrations of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, but they also utilized mythology heavily in their message. And I thought to myself, oh, wait a minute. That makes perfect sense. And that goes actually with the narration which we were speaking about. Of course it would, you know. During the time period of Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, mythology was huge. Actually, there are some narrations that state that even Aristotle had given Alexander the Great a copy of the Iliad, and he used to keep it with him. He used to snuggle with it. He used to keep it underneath his pillow every night when he was sleeping. And obviously the Iliad, you know that it covers the Trojan War and the story of Achilles and Helen and all of that. And then I thought about the rest of the writings of Plato and Socrates, and we find in there that almost every time that they're trying to explain a philosophical idea, they utilize mythology, and the myths that they came up with actually ended up being some of the most famous and influential and important myths of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Yeah.
And I came to reflect over how not only can truth be hidden in stories, but I also came to reflect upon how that is what is happening also today. And you have storytellers in the form of movie makers, filmmakers, that use these films or these stories that they film and they produce as ways to implant in the subconscious of humanity particular messages. Not all of them are good. Some of them are bad. But in movies quite often, and in, you know, pop culture, right? Video games, music, movies, series. We will often find ancient truths being preserved in there, thus verifying the words of Imam Ahmad al-Hassan alayhi salam, that God speaks to us in all things and that the truth can be found in all things.
Yeah.
I wanted today to actually do something a little bit different with you. I brought with me here an incredible myth. I think it's one of my favorites of all time. And I think that we're going to go, me and you today, we're going to read it. And as we're reading it, we're going to comment on it, and we're going to compare it to our own beliefs and the words of Imam Ahmad al-Hassan alayhi salam, thus proving without a shadow of a doubt to anybody that's ever had doubt before that Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, not only were they prophets of God, but perhaps they were some of the most important and best prophets of all time.
Okay. Okay. That sounds great.
Great. So today we're going to talk about a myth that is found in the Plato's Republic, and it's called the Myth of Ur. Have you ever heard about it before?
Yes. Yes. It's about the afterlife, right?
Yes, it is about the afterlife. It's an incredible one, isn't it? Okay, shall we start?
Yes.
It says, long, long ago, in the land called Pamphylia, a brave man named Er was killed in battle, fighting for his country. The enemy won the field, And it was 10 days before the fellow citizens of Ur could take up the bodies of their dead to give them burial. And they buried the rest where they lay, for decay had done its work on them. But when they found Er's body, behold, it was still fresh. So obviously he's martyred. There's a battle taking place and he's a shaheed. And we can find the concept of the incorruptibility taking place. Like his body is not rotting. Yes. It's actually preserved even 10 days afterwards, right?
Yes. Okay. It's still fresh. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's there. We just want to note that. And so his friends carried the corpse home and laid it on a pyre of logs to be burned after the custom of the country. But even as they set light to the pyre, the dead man sat up and began to speak. And when he was taken down from the pyre and had fully come to himself, he was urgent to tell them the things he had seen and heard in the other world. For this, he said, was a charge laid upon him there. Those that then heard the tale placed it on record, thus it was preserved, and as Er told it, so it is set down here. So the man, he goes and he spends 10 days in the afterlife and he actually comes back. Yeah. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's a story about somebody returning actually back, or he's resurrecting from the dead, actually even before the story of Jesus Christ and the resurrection, right?
Yeah.
And it also goes to show the belief that Socrates and Plato had in the concept of there being an afterlife. And this is something obviously which is clearly shared in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. When the soul of Er departed from his body, it journeyed along with a great company of other souls to a certain fairy place where were two rifts side by side in the earth. And just above each rift, there was an opening in the sky overhead. So two openings in the sky, two in the earth. And between the rifts sat certain judges who passed sentence on the souls according to their works. Only the soul of Ur was not brought to trial. A mysterious voice bade him stand apart and give earnest heed to what passed, for he must carry a report to the land of the living. So he looked and he listened, and he saw that the judges placed tokens of acquittal on the breasts of the righteous souls and caused them to ascend through the right-hand opening in the heavens, while tokens of their guilt were hung on the backs of the unrighteous souls, and they were sent down through the left-hand rift in the earth. All who were thus judged were souls of men who had just died like himself. Well, that's interesting. So now we have not only the concept of an afterlife, but the concept of there being a judgment in the afterlife.
Yeah.
Okay. And people are either bogged down by their sins and they're sent into the earth, which matches precisely and exactly the Jewish narrations on the punishment in the afterlife, where hell and its layers exist within the earth.
Yeah.
This is what's happening here. Or basically the acquittal, the shafa, the intercession, the removal of sin from the backs of the righteous souls in order that they may ascend to the heavens above. So there you go. Also in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you have this concept of heaven being above and hell being below. Same thing taking place here, a clear belief by Socrates and Plato in the concept of a heaven and a hell.
Yeah.
Then he saw also that while the newly disembodied souls were passing upwards or downwards from that place, two other companies of spirits were arriving there, one coming down from the sky opening and the other rising out of the second rift in the earth. Okay, so now we have people that are on earth that are either going down or going up,
yeah,
going to hell, going to heaven, right?
Yeah.
But then you also have this other rift, this other opening, and the other opening.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
It's actually people that are already in heaven, they're coming down, and people that are already in earth, they're coming out.
Okay,
so let's check out what's happening.
That's very interesting.
It is very interesting.
That's reincarnation, right?
That is reincarnation, Tiffany. That is. And the place, as described it, is a great and grassy meadow, wherein the two companies of arriving souls met and mingled. So here people, before they're reincarnating, the people that are coming down and the people that are going up, they're actually like meeting each other.
Okay,
there's talk that's happening. All alike seemed weary, as from long travel, and gladly laid themselves down to rest in the meadow, like men who have gathered from far to some public festival. But the souls that had come down from the heavens were arrayed in raiment white and clean, whereas those who arose out of the earth showed all squalid and dust begrimed. Many greetings passed between souls that recognized each other. Infinite the questions and replies exchanged between the comers from heaven and from the underworld. The former spoke of pleasures and glories indescribable. The latter dwelt with tears and lamentations on the terrible things they had seen and suffered during their pilgrimage below, which they said had lasted 1,000 years.
Wow.
Wow, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And here I got to point out something interesting, and that is that this parallels precisely what is written from Muhammad and the family of Muhammad alayhi salam in the book Al-Haftar Sharif, which Imam Ahmad al-Hassan alayhi salam proclaimed to be the most authentic of all available books today, the most preserved and truest of all available books from Muhammad and the family of Muhammad alayhi salam. It teaches exactly that, that dwelling in hell is not forever and dwelling in heaven is also not forever, that they last in there, I think it was 50,000 years. And then all of a sudden they, you know, have a chance to reincarnate or return back to the earth for more lessons and more learning.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very specific parallel, actually, mm-hmm. that not all people who believe in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam hold this belief that the judgment is like a temporary sentence, basically. Mm-hmm. Like you're not doomed to hellfire forever, but actually you have the opportunity to come back after you've served your sentence. So that's a very, very interesting parallel.
It is. Mm-hmm. It was impossible, Ur said, to repeat in full all the tales to which he eagerly listened. So the hero of the story here, there is listening to like all these tales, like what they saw up there, what they saw down there. But the sum of them came to this: for every crime and misdeed done in the body, each soul paid tenfold retribution after death. That is fascinating, because that reminds me of the hadith of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, in which the Prophet Muhammad said that good deeds are worth 10 times as much. So this concept of a deed being worth tenfold, right, is paralleled here.
Yeah.
Except here it's about the criminals, so that when they go down, just like the good people, when they do a good deed, it's tenfold with Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. Here it's saying the bad people, when they go to hell, they have to pay tenfold. Yeah. And their purgatory lasted 1,000 years, because the full measure of human life was reckoned by the supreme judge as 100 years. That's interesting.
So they got a 100-year sentence, but it was tenfold. They got
exactly
1,000.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
In like manner, the souls of those who had done justice and loved mercy while on earth were rewarded tenfold in paradise. So that confirms actually the words of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad alayhi salam. Now, this next part is really fascinating to me. He learns from these people that the crimes most heavily punished were impiety, disobedience to parents, and the murder of kinsfolk. While they who had honored the gods and their parents and cherished to their own kindred were especially rewarded.
Okay.
That reminds me exactly of what Ahmed al-Hassan al-Islam said about these major sins that are unforgivable. Or not that are unforgivable, but that you must pay the price for it in order for full forgiveness to take place. Like there's this karmic effect that must take place. And when we talked in the Goal of the Wise about what are these things, he said disobedience to the parents, treating them bad, cursing them, whatever a person does to their own parents, they'll see it in their own children. Murder is also one of those things that have heavy karmic effects. And also fornication or zina, impiety. And so we find these three things being mentioned here by Ur in this myth as most heavily punished crimes. It's incredible.
It's extremely fascinating. Wow.
There was a countryman of his own, he said, among the tormented, and this is what he has heard about him. He heard one of the souls ask another where Ardaeus the Great was. Now, this Ardaeus the Great had been the despot king of a city of Pamphylia 1,000 years before Ur's time, and was said to have murdered his aged father and elder brother, besides doing many other wicked deeds. So he's asking about an old tyrant king that everybody knew about that lived 1,000 years before. The soul to whom this question was put gave this answer. Ardaeus is not come, nor is he likely to come here. For as we came, we saw this amongst other fearful sights. Just as we drew near to the rift in the earth and were about to mount up, having passed through our purgatory, obviously this is one of the souls coming from the center of the earth that they're describing to the people of the heaven about this old tyrant. He's saying that as we were passing, drawing near to the rift in the earth and we're about to come out, having passed through our purgatory, we suddenly saw Ardaeus along with some others. I fancy most of them had been tyrants too. Though there were certainly a few private persons who had been guilty of enormous crimes. This company, this group of people, just as they made sure of going up, were driven back by the rift itself. They were unable to ascend like the rest of the souls, which drew together and gave forth a bellow. This it does whenever souls incurably wicked or such as have not yet expiated their sins try to go up. Thereupon certain fierce sentinels, men all aflame they seemed, who understood that signal, dragged away some of the company, seizing them round the waist. Okay, so this is a frightening scene that's taking place. And Ur is describing that there are these sentinels, these angels, these men. They're appearing as men that are all made of fire. And their duty is to basically drag forth and increase the punishment on people who are trying to leave the underworld without having fully paid for their sins, or ones that their sins are so severe that they actually can't leave.
Wow. That's interesting. And that they're tyrants too. Like it means that they would have committed crimes on such a massive scale, right?
Exactly. Your Hitlers, your Stalins, all of the people that ruled unjustly over others. And that shows the dangers that are involved with sitting on the throne when you're not appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And also we have the same kind of concept in Judaism and Islam as well, of there being angels that are appointed in hellfire to torment the people. It's fascinating. It's almost like we're hearing the story from the Prophet Muhammad, or we're hearing it from a Jewish prophet.
Yeah.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't really, if you were to change some of the names, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
No, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
United.
But RDAs and others were bound hand and foot and flung down and flayed with whips and carted like wool upon thorn bushes, which are there on the wayside. And a voice cried to those who were then passing by the reasons for these tortures, and that the victims were about to be cast into nethermost hell. All the terrors we had suffered, and they were manifold, were nothing to the dread we then felt, lest that bellow should sound forth when we tried to go up. And thankful we were that the rift let us pass through in silence. This is so fascinating to me because there are actual narrations from Muhammad and the family of Muhammad alayhi salam that talk about how the depths of hell erupts and the fire rises to the surface whenever there's a very evil person that's put inside or in certain circumstances. And this bellow is exactly what is being described here in this myth that's written by Plato and Socrates. Now, when the souls had rested 7 days in the meadow, they were commanded to leave it and set forth on their journey. 3 days they journeyed, and on the fourth day they came to a place from whence they looked down upon a great belt of light, straight as a pillar, stretched from horizon to horizon. The colors of it were like the rainbow, but more brilliant and pure. After another day's travel, the souls reached the middle of this belt. Then they saw that its ends are fastened to the opposite sides of the sky, which it binds together, and so holds in place the whole revolving heavens. This is what men on earth call the Milky Way. And now where they come to the center of the universe, where sits enthroned the great goddess Necessity, the holder of the lots, who steers the course of all things. There she sits, ever twirling upon her knees a mighty spindle of adamant. And as she twirls it, the seven planets revolve in their orbits. For the whirl of her spindle is not single, like those we know, but eightfold. To imagine it, you must fancy eight shining wheels, fitted each inside the other like a Chinese nest of boxes. Each wheel is the orbit of a planet, except the eighth and outermost, which is that of the so-called fixed stars. The other seven are the wheels of the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Obviously, what he's describing here is the ancient concept of the seven spheres, all right, or the seven heavens, yeah. All right, with each heaven having in it its planetary body that rules over it, the first being the Moon and the final one being Saturn. And we spoke about this in the Hall of Mysteries. And then the eighth sphere is actually the finale, the heavens where the souls go and they rest in that sky that has all of the fixed stars. And he's saying that Necessity is kind of ruling over all of it. The one that in her hands is destiny, and it's reflected down through these different heavenly bodies.
It's very, very interesting.
It is very interesting. And it obviously it goes along with everything that we've been discussing recently in the Hermetic series and the Hall of Mysteries. In later times, so now we have Enoch, his words aligning up with the words of Muhammad, with the words of Socrates, with the words of Plato, with the words of the Hebrew prophets.
Yes.
In later times, men came to think of these eight divisions of the heavens not as wheels, but as spheres. Thus it is that our own poets have spoken of the music of the spheres, meaning the same music which now enchanted Ur and his companions. But a sphere is a ball, and what they saw, by his account, were not balls, but wheels or circles of light. And upon each wheel stands a siren, a weird and beautiful shape, half bird, half woman, uttering one note all the while, as it were the note of a harp string. And the eight notes uttered by the sirens make up a harmony most divine. Round about the throne of necessity sit three other goddesses, each likewise on a throne. These are her daughters, the three fates, whose names are Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos. Their robes are white and glistering, and the head of each is crowned with a garland. They are seated at equal distances apart and at equal distances from the throne of their mother. Ur beheld their faces, solemn and vast, like the face of the Sphinx that is in Egypt. But the face of necessity was veiled. He saw that Clotho, with her right hand guided now, and in the outermost rim of the great spindle, whirl as it spun. Atropos, with her left hand, guided the innermost, but Lachesis, from time to time, laid either hand on both those circles. And the three, with scarce moving lips, were chanting a song that no man knoweth. After this fashion, then is the spinning of the fates. Now the souls no sooner came to this place than it was required of them to draw near to Lachesis. Beside her stood an interpreter. As such he was named to them, who marshaled them in order before her throne. Then he took from her lap a heap of discs marked with numbers and a heap of inscribed tablets. The numbered discs were lots, and the tablets were plans of lives.
Wow.
For each tablet bore the name and description of a life on earth. Set out like the chart of a voyage, the lives were of every kind, no two alike. There were lives of all living things, and of all sorts and conditions of men, from kings to beggars. But this Ur saw by and by. When the interpreter had gathered up these things from the lap of the goddess, he mounted a high pulpit and made proclamation as follows. The word of Lachesis, the virgin daughter of necessity, ye souls, creatures of a day, here beginneth a new cycle of mortal life for you, that are subject to mortality. Your earthly fate shall not be chosen for you, but you shall choose it yourselves. Let him who draws the first lot be the first to choose a life, whereunto he shall be bound without recall. But virtue owns no master. He that honors her shall possess her more abundantly, and he that neglects her shall have less of her. The chooser alone shall be answerable for his choice. It shall not be laid to the charge of heaven. This is incredible. So now we got a scene here where the souls are rising into the heavens and they're standing in front of a virgin daughter, which kind of resonates with the concept of the Virgin Mary in Christianity. But the most important thing that I want to focus on here is this idea that there are these CDs, there's these discs, right, of the heavens, so to speak. And each disc has on there a plan, a life, an incarnation, somebody's name, and all things that are going to happen in his life or her life. And the souls are being presented with an opportunity that they choose for themselves the type of life that they are going to incarnate into. And this goes precisely with, it's exactly how Imam Ahmad al-Hasan alayhi salam described things to be. That the person who, and we find these themes actually living together within this myth and not contradictory to one another, as many Jews, Christians, and Muslims believe the two concepts to be contradictory, the concept of reincarnation and the concept of heaven and hell. Here we see them interwoven perfectly, just as Imam Imam Ahmad al-Hassan described them, with hell and heaven being at the end of a cycle of reincarnations, not lasting forever, and souls eventually coming out and being able also to reincarnate, and not only reincarnate, but they're the ones that choose their lives. And Imam Ahmad al-Hassan said that 89% of your life, all right, is kind of something which is ordained or necessary, right? The daughter of necessity or fate, so to speak, things that are you've already chosen that will be. It's like an avatar or a game character that you are put inside. There are things that you just have to go through as part of the storyline in the game, and you're allotted this 11% freedom. And this 11% freedom here in the myth is being described as virtue.
Okay.
Which whoever honors virtue will possess more of virtue, right? And whoever dishonors it or abandons it will possess left. So we have this kind of 11%, and the 11% is virtue.
Okay. And that's something that you have the ability to exercise your free will to...
Exactly. That's where our free will lies. Okay. Our free will in the beginning was choosing the life. Yeah. And our free will afterwards is in the amount of virtue that we're going to obtain and display during our life.
Okay. I mean, it's almost eerie listening to this being read to me with all that I know from the teachings of Imam Ahmad al-Hassan, because it's just exactly the same.
It is exactly the same.
It's very... I mean, I have no words to describe it. Like, it's actually giving me goosebumps, because I just can't believe that that something like this has been preserved throughout history, and we find that it exactly parallels what Imam Ahmad al-Hassan and you have taught us.
And I think that this also serves as proof for who can be the successor of Plato and Socrates, except for a man who believes in and teaches and propagates the ideas that were preserved by Socrates and Plato.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've pointed out so beautifully, it's the exact same teachings that were taught by all of the prophets and messengers throughout time, including the Abrahamic prophets.
Exactly. Unfortunately, here they are, they're talking to their people, and so they create a myth. And the word myth becomes uncomfortable for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And they say, we don't believe in myths. And so they discard it. The myth contains figures that are called gods. But really what they're talking about is necessity. It's talking about fate. It's talking about concepts like these. And because they're referred to as gods, because the people at the time had referred to them as gods, they were quickly and swiftly rejected.
Yeah.
Okay, let's continue. Let's see what's happening, because we're really at a very exciting point now. Now the CDs are all out.
Yeah.
Now the souls are being commanded to choose. When he had thus spoken, the interpreter scattered the lots amongst the crowd below. And each soul took up the one that fell nearest to him, except for Ur, obviously, because Ur was preserved. As just his mission is just to go to the afterlife to watch and to report. He's not going to a new life. Who was forbidden to do so. Then the plans of life, which Ur could see, were many more than enough to go around. So there were more plans than there were souls.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So people have plenty of options. Nobody has an excuse. They were all laid out on the ground before the souls, who came forward to make their choice in order, according to the number of the lot each had drawn. As I have said, there were all sorts of lives to choose from, and in each sort there was infinite variety. Among the lives of kings and princes, for instance, there were some that ended in full power and prosperity. So some lives are the lives of kings, actually. That's an incarnation that you can choose. You can choose to be a king in a life that ends in full power and prosperity. And others that met with a sudden and disastrous close murder. And other lives that ended with exile or beggary. There were also lives of famous men, some renowned for personal beauty, others for strength and skill, which made them great athletes, others again for noble birth and illustrious homage. And there were lives in plenty of men not distinguished for anything. lives too of celebrated women and of women without celebrity. But Ur saw that unlike health, wealth, poverty, disease, and other such accompaniments, goodness or badness of character was nowhere included in these life plans. Okay? So what does this mean? This means basically that all of the people that are famous athletes, they're famous athletes because those souls chose that life as an incarnation. They wanted that life, they chose that life, and they became that. They're living out their choice. Mm-hmm. The people that are celebrities, they chose to be famous celebrities. The people that are king, they chose to incarnate as famous kings. Each person chose their life, okay? But Ur found that in there, fate had dictated how healthy these people are going to be. So health was something that was determined already. That was part of the CD, part of the plan. It comes with the incarnation, okay? If a particular king has cancer, for example, okay, but that's your choice. You chose it. It was something that was written with it. Okay. How wealthy that individual is, it's part of what was written in the CD. How poor the person was, same thing. What type of diseases, same thing. But there was something that was notably absent, and that is how good or bad the character is. So each life had the potential to be a good one or a bad one. Okay. The character could be good or bad.
Okay, it's the virtue, yeah?
The virtue. This set him thinking, and as it seemed to him, the reason was that a man's character is not part of his destiny, nor born with him, but is the outcome of his actions. That, he thought, was what the interpreter meant by saying that virtue owns no master. For a soul might choose to be a king, but not to be a good king. Because virtue is not bound up with any one kind of life, high or low, rich or poor, but may be sought and won in all, though more hardly in some than in others. And this matches precisely what Jesus said when he spoke about, for example, the idea that it's harder for a rich man to enter into heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Virtues available to that rich man, religions available to that rich man, righteousness is available to him, but it's more difficult, it's more hard to seek it and win it than with other individuals.
So some lives or packages become more of a test on you.
Exactly. And so thought the wisest teacher of ancient Greece, who once told to his disciples this tale of Ur, the messenger from the other world, as he called him. This teacher, even Socrates, said that as for the spirits in Ur's vision, so also for us upon earth, a great choice is ordained, and that the only knowledge worth a man striving after is the knowledge which will enable him at all times and in all places to choose between the good and the evil life. Counting as good the life which will lead the soul nearer to righteousness, and as evil the life which will draw it towards unrighteousness, and reckoning all besides as dust in the balance. But turn we again to our tale. Now, this is amazing, and obviously Plato pays homage to Socrates and honors him as his teacher and as his imam and as the speaker of the tale. And he says in here something which matches precisely what Imam Ahmad al-Hassan alayhi salam taught, teaches, and says, and that is that the most important of all knowledge, that which is worth learning, is discipline. He said that this is the most important thing for the believer to learn how to be disciplined. And you learn how to be disciplined by basically installing in yourself the righteous virtues and abandoning the evil vices, right? The soldiers of ignorance and the soldiers of the mind. Plato is saying precisely the same thing here, that Socrates considered the only knowledge or the most important knowledge that's worth seeking is that which enables a person to be righteous, knowledge of the virtues. And that all other knowledge, like Imam Ahmad al-Hassan alayhi salam said, is knowledge that can be easily taught, easily attained, the knowledge of the past, the knowledge of the present, the knowledge of the future, the different sciences. These are all less important and irrelevant, actually, in the long grand scheme of things. As the souls were coming forward to survey the life plans spread before them, the interpreter's voice was heard again. "Even for the last comer," he said, "there remains a life not undesirable and nowise evil, provided he chooses it with prudence and lives it strenuously. Let not the first chooser be heedless, nor the last discouraged." Meaning what? Meaning everybody's going to have a fair choice. Even if you're the last to choose an incarnation, all incarnations hold the great potential, right, of great success. "Thereupon, the soul who had drawn the first lot advanced." Okay, so now the choosing begins. Let the games begin. "And after some hasty glances at lives of kings." So look at, we got insight now at the soul, where he's drawn first, to positions of power, authority, riches, comfort. "He hastily looks at the lives of kings, for with chose the most absolute and powerful monarchy he could find."
Okay.
So the first one to go forward, this is what he chose.
Okay. So he's lusting after power.
Basically. Yeah. And he chose that, number one, quickly. He looked quickly at different kings and monarchs, and he just found the one that appeared to be the most powerful, and he chose it quickly. And it gives insight here into the first incarnations to go. "But reckless and greedy that he was, he had not looked to see what else there might be in that life of power and pride before he chose it. So he never noticed the fearful things it had in store for him, whereof the crowning horror was to banquet unawares on his own children's flesh. To such revenge would his rule goad his subjects." So this soul that went forward and chose this incarnation, it just saw the glittering aspects of it, and it discarded a lot of the other aspects of it, and it chose it. And little did it know that at some point in its life, him and his companions would be fed the flesh of his own children, apparently by one of the enemies. And so that is a horror that he didn't pay attention to because he was blinded by the authority and the kingship. Wow. "Therefore, when this soul had taken up the life plan he desired and studied it a while," so now after he took it and chose it, "he fell to beating his breast and lamenting aloud. And unmindful of the interpreter's words of warning, he laid the blame of his miseries not upon himself, but upon fortune and destiny." Right? How so many of us blame God for the misfortunes that happen in our life, or for our so-called bad luck, or for the conditions in which we find ourselves, whether it be poor or sick or whatever. And all of these choices, these were our choices. We're the ones that chose them, not fortune and destiny. "And indeed upon anybody and everybody rather than himself." And I think that this is a perfect exemplification of the unity, how choice and destiny live side by side, how fate and how the human choice are, one being. And I remember there was a hadith where somebody asked one of the imams, what is the relationship between fate and destiny? He told one of them to bend a leg, and stand on the other foot. And he said, there's choice and there's destiny. You know, so they actually go together. They're part of one being.
Yeah.
What surprised Ur, not a little, was that this rash and misguided soul was one of those that had come from heaven, actually. So this soul that chose this incarnation and was blaming the stars and death, and it was blaming destiny and fate and fortune, and chose to be this king, was actually not a soul from the people of hell. It was a soul from the people of heaven. He heard also that its former life on earth had been that of a virtuous, law-abiding citizen in a well-governed state. It seems, thought Ur, that obeying laws, however good they are, is not enough to make a man's soul good.
Okay.
So the Sharia and following the Sharia is not enough. A soul, in order to be a good soul, cannot rely solely on living a life where they're just praying, fasting, abiding by ritualistic laws from God. It takes much more than that. And that is the essence of Imam Ahmad al-Hassan's teachings and the essence of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad's teachings and the essence of the words of the prophets and the messengers, that there has to be this jihad against the self, this transformation that takes place.
Okay. Yeah, I see the soul was, although he had been a law-abiding citizen, like he had followed all the rules, he still lacked discipline,
like
a deep discipline.
Okay. And he ended up making a lustful choice that he would come to regret.
Okay.
Or how could this one, being given free choice, have chosen to become a despot? And as he looked on, he observed that more than half the souls who made hasty and mistaken choices had likewise come from heaven.
Wow.
While most of those that had come from beneath the earth chose with far greater care.
Okay. Wow.
This, he was told, was because the former had not known the discipline of pain, which the others had both seen and felt in the underworld. So here comes the benefit of being in hellfire. Here comes the benefit of the experience down there, is that it disciplines you and it makes you less likely to lust after harmful lives and harmful incarnations. And so the people that are coming out of hell, they're choosing lives in which they're beggars. They're like, no, I don't want to be a king. I want to be a beggar. Okay. No, I just want to be a simple poor person, because they don't want to end up in that same place again.
Yes.
While the people that came from heaven, all right, many of them got into heaven, all right, or rose or were forgiven or were acquitted because they abided by the Sharia, right? Yeah. They did just enough good by not committing any bad, right? Yeah. To end up acquitted of their sins, but this did not benefit them in the long run, for in future lives, they chose destructive incarnations.
It also makes sense why reincarnation is so necessary, why there has to be round after round after round, because it's really not enough, right? To experience one lifetime, like you have to go through multiple tests in order to like have your metal truly tested.
It was indeed a wonderful sight, Ur said, to watch the souls choosing their lives. What an incredible sight. A sight to cause at once laughter and tears and astonishment. And that reminds me of the hadith of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, that the angels above, they see the human beings and their lives on earth, and they're astonished at how some of them end up being saved, or some of them end up succeeding after they were almost destined to fail. The choice seemed nearly always to be guided by the happenings of the soul's former life. So each person now that's choosing an incarnation, Ur realized, he's like, oh, this guy was poor in the last incarnation, you know, so obviously now he's choosing to be rich. And this person was in hell, because of bad deeds in the last incarnation, so now he's choosing basically to walk beside the wall and to be very careful. But the previous incarnation is always having an effect, almost always having an effect on the choice for the next incarnation. This is another reason why people need to be paying attention to their actions here. And that's precisely what Al-Hafiz Sharif said, that each incarnation would affect the one after that. It's precisely what Imam Ahmad al-Hassan al-Salam also taught, that our actions here would be felt in the next life. Thus he beheld the soul that had lived on earth as Orpheus, choosing a swan's life, because he could not endure to be born again of a woman. So great was the horror of womankind that those savage women had given him, who tore him to pieces in their frenzy. So here's a guy who suffered at the hands of women so tremendously that he chose to have nothing to do with women, not whatsoever. He wouldn't even be born from a woman's womb, so he chose to be a swan instead. Isn't that incredible?
That's very interesting, yes.
And we have here also the concept of misuchia, or the concept of reincarnation in the form of lower life forms of animals, also taking place here, also mentioned by Imam Ahmad al-Hassan al-Salam, Islam, the Hadith of the Ahlul Bayt, the Quran, Al-Hafiz Sharif, being spoken about long, hundreds of years before the Quran was ever written, you know, by these great philosopher prophets, peace be upon them. And the soul of the blind bard, Thamyris, chose to be reborn as a nightingale, because of the affliction he had known as a man. But Ur saw a swan choosing to give up its nature and become a man, and other souls that had been singing birds doing likewise. Okay. So here we have birds that are choosing to, or animals that are choosing now, or elevating enough to reincarnate as humans. And we have that Hafiz Sharif, yes, in the scene where Imam Sadiq is speaking with one of his companions. And they were speaking about somebody, and the Imam said that yesterday, meaning in his last incarnation, he used to be a rooster. Okay, now he's a man. And so animals do have the ability to come. And Imam Ahmad al-Hassan al-Salam spoke about how animals enter into heaven and no animals enter into heaven. How is that? He said that animals become humans, and humans that used to be animals can enter into heaven, but there are no animals that enter directly into heaven, because it's not a heaven if you're in one of these animal bodies, right? Yeah. And he spoke about animals that were great animals that incarnated and are actually in this dawah today in the form of human beings, like the whale of Jonah, for example, or the donkey of Balaam ibn Bawra, or the dog of the people of the cave, yeah, or the ant of Solomon, or the hudhud of Solomon. All of these animals and many, many more had elevated until they became human beings. And here we find the same thing happening. Animals becoming human beings and people becoming animals.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Now, the soul that drew the 20th lot chose a lion's life. It was the soul of Ajax, who would have no more to do with the race of men, remembering the baseness and injustice he had seen in them when the armor of Achilles was awarded not to him, but to Odysseus. Next came the soul of Agamemnon. His miserable end had so taught him the vanity of human ambition that he chose the life of an eagle. So obviously he's talking about now, he's throwing in the characters from the Iliad, yeah, and he's showing in there what was the end of them and how some of them became mesh, actually. Yeah. Not long after, Ur saw the soul of Atalanta, still garbed as a huntress, fair and terrible she looked, as when she was wont to run races with her suitors. She had drawn one of the middle lots, and casting her eyes on the life plans that yet remained, she saw an athlete's life, all full of honors and rich prizes. She paused, then stooped and took it up quickly, like one unable to resist a lure. And Ur thought that just so she must have looked when she halted to pick the golden apple that Melanion threw her while they ran together. and thereby lost the race to him. Then he saw the soul of Ippias, he that made the wooden horse, and was said to make up in craftsmanship what he lacked in courage, being no lover of fighting. Ippias did not belie the old report of him, for he chose to live again as a woman skilled in weaving and needlework.
Okay.
And then among the last, he saw some way off a soul that seemed changing from human form into that of an ape. He heard that this was Thersites, the buffoon, and was not surprised at his choosing to become the animal whose nature had been nearest to his own. So here, obviously, we have souls that actually, due to lack of discipline, you know, they end up resembling animals, and they actually transform, and they become, and they end up living and choosing lives that are similar to its own self.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there's verses in the Quran that are saying almost exactly that, right?
Exactly. Precisely exactly that. And in the Naft Sharif and in the narrations of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad, which spoke about how there are, like, for example, a person who seduces women that don't belong to him, he ends up incarnating as a peacock. Or murderers reincarnating in the forms of lizards, or tyrannical kings that reincarnate in the forms of elephants or bears, or in some cases lions, like the narration which spoke about Nebuchadnezzar. And so the same thing is happening here. The last lot of all, as it chanced, was drawn by the soul of Odysseus. Okay, let's see this last guy that's choosing here. That great adventurer, it seemed, had been purged of all his ambition and love of roving by the memories of his troubled past. For when last of all he came forward to make his choice, he went to and fro a long while, looking for a quiet, retired life amongst those that were left over. With some pains he found one, lying where it had been contemptuously thrown aside by the other souls. As soon as he set eyes on it, he eagerly took it up. "This is the life for me," he said, "and the one I should have taken even if I had drawn the first lot and had first choice of all." So in the end, it shows that even those who picked the most glamorous lives and lived the most adventures in life, in the end, they found that none of it was worth it due to the pains and sufferings that are associated with it. And that the best of lives are the simplest of lives, the ones that allow for most peace. Now, when all the souls had chosen their lives, they advanced one by one to the throne of Lachesis and saw, as it were, a cloud of winged shapes, some bright and others dusky, hovering around her. These were fortunes, one of which belonged to each of the lives they had chosen. And Lachesis gave every soul into the keeping of its own fortune, who would thenceforth guide it through its earthly course. This fortune first led the soul to Clotho, making it pass under her outstretched hand that was twirling the great spindle whorl, so that the hand just touched its head in passing. Next they came to Atropos, and the soul passed under her hand likewise. For by the touch of these sister fates, each soul is bound irrevocably to its chosen life. After this, the whole multitude passed through a great archway. Now there's a great archway. The souls are passing through it underneath the throne of necessity. Was permitted to pass through also, but not until the rest had done so, and they all journeyed on to the plane of forgetfulness. Wow. Yeah. Now we're going to comment on this here in a minute. The air of that place is stifling. So terrible is the heat, and there is not a tree or a blade of grass to be seen. A river called Cairnot runs through the plain, and no vessel ever made can hold the water of that river, for it bursts whatever it is put into, even vessels of iron. As evening drew on, the host of souls took up quarters for the night on the riverbank. Then it was made known to them that all who come here must drink a certain quantity of that water. would gladly have drunk of being athirst, but he alone was somehow held back from doing so. All the other souls drank immediately, and at that instant, they forgot everything that had ever happened to them. Oh, my goodness. This reminds us of what Al-Haftar Sharif talked about and the narrations of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad and the Imam Ahmad al-Hassan about there being this river in the afterlife, a river called Salsabila, yeah, that the souls are dipped into or that drink from it, and it causes them to forget all of the pains and the sufferings and the things that happened in their previous lives before they move on to their next incarnation or before they move on to heaven and hell, because a new life could never be lived or heaven can never be enjoyed except that alongside with the memories of all that which had happened before, even if they were pleasant memories, because a person would long for that which is gone and that which they lost. Mm-hmm. The only ones in the Islamic narrations that don't get to drink from this are actually the people that are going to hellfire or going to a bad place or going to the body of an animal, so that they may always remember the reasons why they are there. Mm-hmm. That's incredible. Plato and Socrates, you know, if somebody was a disbeliever, they would say that obviously Muhammad and the family of Muhammad and even certain narrations in Christianity and Judaism has stolen from and plagiarized from these individuals that they have now thrown out, or the majority of the Islamic scholars and Christian and Jewish scholars have thrown out of the fold of prophethood.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that the same concept exists in some Gnostic Christian writings too, like drinking the water of forgetfulness. So, it's absolutely amazing.
Okay, so what happens when they drink from it and they forget everything? Ursal, many drink more than the ordained quantity. So they were told, each person was told, you're allowed to drink this much. You're allowed to drink a cup full. You're allowed to drink half a cup. You're allowed to drink 2 cups. You're allowed to drink 10. Ursal, many drink more than the ordained quantity. And it was told him that this was imprudent, for though the water brings forgetfulness to all for a time, those who drink only their allotted portion may regain on earth vague memories of their past lives, and things seen in the other worlds, like the Adam world and things like this. So there are souls here on earth that will partially remember previous lives. And the reason for that, Socrates says, is because when they went to the river of Salsabila or Kernat, right, or the river of forgetfulness, they did as they were instructed and they only drunk a certain amount. But the ones that can't remember and don't have memories of their past lives, it's actually their fault too.
Yeah.
It's their fault because they drank more than their allotted share.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
That's so fascinating.
That is.
Yeah. I'm really speechless.
Which will be a spring of wisdom to them and an inward light. So memories are important, and the things that you saw in the afterlife and in previous incarnations are important, and they serve as guidance, wisdom, and an inner light for those who can remember. When the souls had all laid them down to sleep, and it was about midnight, there came a clap of thunder and an earthquake, and that moment they were carried up to their berth, this way and that through the darkness like shooting stars. As for how he came back to his body, he could not tell. I think that's also important for us to point out. It's like almost every single line, every paragraph, we're finding similarities. Here it's saying that these souls were carried to their birth. So they only went to the child after it was born or during birth, not before. And that's what Al-Haftar Sharif says, that good souls are not placed in the womb, because being placed in the womb of a woman while she's pregnant would not be a comfortable position, nor would the birth process be a comfortable position for the child. This way and that through the darkness like shooting stars. As for how he came back to his body, he could not tell. And there's a comparison here, by the way, between, okay, so we talked about how the Hermetic writings, the souls were like stars in the sky,
yeah,
right? The stable stars in the sky. Here it's saying that the shooting stars, the souls are like that. They're like shooting stars.
Okay.
Stars that were above that are coming to the earth. As for how he came back to his body, he could not tell. All he knew was that he suddenly opened his eyes in the light of dawn and found himself stretched out on the funeral pyre. And that is the end of the myth of as written and preserved by Plato and Socrates.
I mean, that text is extremely rich with parallels to the teachings of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad and the teachings of Imam Ahmad al-Hassan and all of the prophets and the messengers. And it's such a testament to what this dawah teaches, which is that these were, in fact, prophets of God, even though the people didn't recognize them as such.
And, exactly. And it also serves as a testament, because when I was reading this myth for the first time that I read it, it brought me to tears. It brought me to astonishment, and it brought great joy to me. Just as was described in there, that Ur was feeling and the souls were feeling. And I think that it serves as an important reminder that in myths lie great truths. In this very myth that we read here, actually, and I think that now many of our viewers can testify that in some ways it contained more information about the soul and answered more questions about the soul than some of the narrations even of Muhammad and the family of Muhammad alayhi salam, and the Hebrew prophets and messengers. And the description was not only more accurate, but it had more detail. And that goes to show that there is great knowledge hidden in myths that are yet to be explored. And inshallah, in future episodes, Tiffany, we're going to go through many more myths of many different prophets and messengers that were unrecognized throughout history. And inshallah, we will continue in our search for virtue and wisdom.
Thank you so much, Abbas.
God bless you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.